hamburgers in the food trucks had become something of a ritual. It was February of 2017, and I was in the back row of a fully armored black FBI Suburban. The middle row of seats had been removed, so I sat in one of the two seats in the back. I'd gotten used to watching the world pass by through the small, dark, bulletproof side windows. I was on the way to yet another classified congressional briefing on the 2016 Russian election interference. Appearing in front of members of Congress was difficult on a good day, and usually disheartening. Nearly everyone appeared to take a side, and seemed to listen only to find the nuggets that fit their desired spin. They would argue with each other through you. Mr. Director, if someone said X, wouldn't that person be an idiot? And the reply would come through you as well. Mr. Director, if someone said that someone who said X was an idiot, wouldn't that person be the real idiot? When the subject involved the most contentious election in memory, the discussion in the aftermath was even more vicious, with few willing or able to put aside their political interests to focus on the truth. Republicans wanted to be assured that the Russians hadn't elected Donald Trump. Democrats, still reeling from the election results weeks before, wanted the opposite. There was little common ground. It was like having Thanksgiving dinner with a family eating together by court order. The FBI, with me as its director, was caught in the middle of the partisan bile. This was not really new. We had been sucked into the election starting in July 2015, when our seasoned professionals at the FBI began a criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton's handling of classified information on her personal email system. It was a time when even using the terms criminal and investigation was a source of needless controversy. A year later, in July 2016, we began an investigation into whether there was a massive Russian effort to influence the presidential vote by hurting Clinton and helping elect Donald Trump. This was an unfortunate, if unavoidable, situation for the Bureau. Though it is part of the executive branch, the FBI is meant to stand apart from politics in American life. Its mission is to find the truth. To do that, the FBI can't be on anyone's side except the country's. Of course, members of the Bureau may have their own private political views, just like anybody else. But when its people rise in a courtroom or in Congress to report what they've found, they can't be seen as Republicans or Democrats or part of anyone's tribe. 40 years ago, Congress created a 10-year term for the FBI director to reinforce that independence. But in a capital city and a country torn by partisan conflict, the FBI's separateness was both alien and confusing and constantly tested. This placed an enormous strain on career professionals in the agency, especially as their motives were routinely being questioned. I glanced at Greg Brower, the FBI's new head of congressional affairs, who was riding to the Hill with me. Greg was a 53-year-old Nevadan with salt-and-pepper hair. We'd hired him from a law firm. Prior to that, he'd been the chief federal prosecutor in Nevada and also an elected state legislator. He knew the business of law enforcement and also the challenging and very different business of politics. His job was to represent the FBI in the shark tank of Congress. But Brower hadn't signed up for this kind of turmoil, which only grew after the shocking result of the 2016 election. Greg hadn't been part of the Bureau for long, so I was worried this craziness and stress might be getting to him. I half wondered whether he might fling open the door of the Suburban and head for the hills. At a younger age, with fewer turns at the witness table in Congress, I might have considered exactly the same thing. As I looked at him, I assumed he was thinking what I was thinking. How did I end up here? I could see that worry on Brower's face, so I broke the silence. How great is this? I said in a booming voice that no doubt caught the attention of the agents in the front seats. Brower looked at me. We're in the shit, I said. Now he seemed confused. Did the FBI director just say shit? Yep, I had. We're waist deep in the shit, I added with an exaggerated smile, holding my arms out to show just how deep it was. Where else would you want to be? Mangling the St. Crispin's Day speech from Shakespeare, I added, people abed in England tonight will wish they were here. He laughed and visibly lightened. I lightened too. Although I'm sure the thought of leaping from the speeding car still crossed Greg's mind, the tension was broken. We took a breath together. For a moment, we were two people on a road trip. Everything was going to be okay. Then the moment passed. We pulled up to the U.S. Capitol to talk about Putin and Trump and collusion allegations and secret dossiers and who knew what else. It was just another high-pressure moment in what was one of the craziest, most consequential, and even educational periods of my, and some might say the country's, life. And more than once I found myself thinking that same question, how on earth did I end up here? Chapter 1. The Life. To not think of dying is to not think of living. Jan Arden. The life begins with a lie. In 1992, I was an assistant U.S. attorney in New York City, and those were the words I heard from a senior member of one of the most notorious crime families in the United States. Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano was the highest-ranking American mobster ever to become a federal witness. He'd flipped to avoid a life sentence in jail, and also because he'd heard government tapes in which his boss, John Gotti, said bad things about him behind his back. Now in our custody, Gravano introduced me to the rules of mafia life. Membership in La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours, became official only after an oath taken in a secret ceremony in front of the boss, underboss, and consigliere of the family. After the ceremony, the criminal would be known as a made man. The first question of the secret initiation was, "Do you know why you are here?" The chosen one was required to answer no, despite the fact that, as Gravano explained, only an idiot wouldn't know why the leaders of the family were gathered with him in the basement of some nightclub. For nearly two decades, the leaders of the American Mafia agreed there would be no new members. In 1957, they closed the books, a term reflecting that the process involved the actual sharing of paper among the Mafia families, containing the aliases and real names of their members, because of serious concerns about quality control and penetration by informants. But in 1976, they agreed that each family could make 10 new members, and then the books would be closed again, with new members only admitted to replace those who died. For each family, those 10 were the most hardened all-star gangsters who had been frozen out for years. Gravano came into the Mafia as part of that superclass. Inducting 10 new members after so long a shutdown obviously put burdens on the criminal enterprise. In a typical induction ceremony, an initiate is expected to hold in his cupped hands a flaming picture of a Catholic saint, stained with blood dripped from his trigger finger, and recite, "My soul should burn like this saint if I ever betray Cosa Nostra." Gravano recalled that when they reached